Welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shea Mutella. And before we get into our main discussion on Elstree Calling and an Elastic Affair with Tom, I just wanted to give a special shout out to our good friend Jason Cullimore, who's composed our new theme for Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I really appreciate it. It's really beautiful. It's something unique. Jason and I met for lunch the other day, and when I told him what I'd like, he asked me, what kind of music and what kind of feel do I want? Do I want something light? And I said, you know, I think I want something a little bit, you know, darker and moodier, you know, something that Bernard Herrmann and Hitchcock would have done, you know, around Psycho or North by Northwest, something like that. And I think he came up with something really special that really truly evokes the Hitchcock films. So I really think this captivates the feel of the show going forward. This is going to be the theme song that you're going to hear on all of our episodes. Please be sure to check out Jason's other work. He's a wonderful composer. He's from here in Regina, Saskatchewan, but he's an award-winning composer. He's won several Canadian awards for composition. And his website is jasoncullimore.com. That's J-A-S-O-N-C-U-L-L-I-M-O-R-E. And we greatly appreciate Jason and his contribution to our show. Well, let's move on to the main discussion with Tom. Good evening, and welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host for today, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me today live in the studio is...
Tom Caldwell, your other Regina guy on the show here. Thank you for having me over to your lovely house.
Yeah, you may notice a difference in sound quality today. It's because we're actually sitting in my basement, live in the same room, rather than over the internet like we normally do. And normally we record our audio individually and then I edit them together. But with us sitting here, it makes it a heck of a lot easier on my editing because I don't really have much to do.
Right so. On. Anytime we can avoid extra work for Brandon, that's a good thing.
I love it, yes. We will be joined by our foreign correspondent, Chris Haig, in a little while. He will be... actually, he's not going to be on this episode, is he? We're recording two episodes today.
Yeah.
He'll be on the next episode when we cover Juno and the Paycock. But in this one here, we're just kind of doing a little episode to cover two quick little oddities that Hitchcock did that came out after Blackmail. And so the first one that we're going to be talking about is a short film that's now considered lost called An Elastic Affair. And An Elastic Affair is a 10-minute short comedy film from 1930 that was directed by Alfred Hitchcock. And it features two winners of a film acting scholarship, which was sponsored by the British film magazine Film Weekly. The film was shown on the 19th of January, 1930, at a ceremony at the London Palladium, and the two winners were presented with their award in the form of movie contracts with the film producer John Maxwell of British International Pictures. So this film is now considered lost, but the two people that were in the film were Cyril Butcher, who played the boy, and Eileen Despard, who played the girl. And these two never had much of a career afterwards. Other than Elastic Affair, Eileen was only in a film from 1931 called Children of Chance and a film from 1932 called Double Dealing. And Cyril was only in one other film in 1931 called Nightbirds. So there's not really much to talk about, but I just wanted to make sure that we acknowledged it because it is one of the little oddities that Hitchcock has in his career around this time. So, you know, if any of you guys happen to have a copy of this, there's lots of people looking for it because it's considered lost, but, you know, it's probably gone.
We've faced this situation before where we're trying to talk about a film that we can't watch. We can't, mm-hmm. we cannot view it. It doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the technological fallbacks from that era when films didn't last. They deteriorated. They caught on fire.
Yep.
They didn't have a lot of copies made. They got lost, and, you know, they're lost for history, and we just don't have the luxury of even being able to view them. So all we can really do is look at any writing that was done about the film, either critical reviews in the press or the movie company's own internal promotions of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a challenge, and so I'm not sure much we can say about this one, but...
Yeah, we're not going to be able to say much more. I think that's about it that we can say. So we'll move on to the other film that we're going to be talking about today, which is called Elstree Calling.
This is a variety show, right? Yeah. Like it's a, the version I watched was an hour and 20 minutes, and it's a vaudeville stage production. So these are a collection of dancing segments, stand-up comedy, vaudevillian, big band orchestras. There's a wonderful section where there's a Mr. Calthrope is a Shakespearean actor, and he keeps trying to bring out onto the stage. He wants to present Shakespeare, which is so unpopular with anybody involved in the show that they don't want to do this. So there's quite a lot of gags where he gets shut down trying to present Shakespeare.
Yeah, that one where there's that part where the curtains kept falling down in front of him, and it happened like five times, which is way more times than you would think would normally happen. Yeah,
and he keeps walking forward through the closed curtains, and they close another set of curtains. And there's a, later in the episode, he did one where he's like the black tuxedo magician with the rabbit and the props, and he does this wonderful sight gag, where he pulls a British flag out of his coat pocket, and it just keeps coming and coming, and you can actually see the man, the prop assistant behind him, handing him the flag through the curtain, which is a funny little glitch that makes it more fun to watch. And that idea of the Shakespearean presentation not being popular, I did a production in about 1992 at Shaw Cable in Saskatoon, where we did a thing called the Zamboni's comedy special. It was a skit comedy show with eight actors, and one of the bits we did was 60-second Shakespeare. We would do an entire Shakespearean play in 1 minute. And this was a classic thing that theater people have always done when they do a comedy review, is they try and incorporate Shakespeare. So I really appreciated that. And there was... You really liked the... I apologize for not knowing the guy's name. The big dude, the fat dude that was the drummer. And the xylophone player.
Yeah.
And he had a proper big band with him.
Yep.
And he was proud of his girth. Like, this dude was...
He owned
huge.
It.
He was huge.
He owned
not
it.
Not in popularity, but in mass. Yes. And there was a billboard over the stage that must have been 30 feet high of this big cutout of him in his penguin tuxedo with this huge belly, like a very, very funny character. And he did a section where he was playing the xylophone. And like you said, he's a very skilled xylophone player. And he did another segment later where he's drumming, and he's like, does this remind you of going to church? And he starts playing the drums and the tambourine and sort of almost like stand-up comedy drumming.
Yeah, he's like, this is a train. And he's like, he made it sound like a chain, like... But the we were talking earlier, Tom and I went for lunch before this, and so we were talking a bit about the films, and yeah, he's doing this scene where he's just like walking up and down his xylophone, and he's just like tapping and just moving his arm, and he's really talented, he's really cool, so I really enjoyed him. I thought he was the best part of it.
But this was a vaudeville show. Like this, back in the 20s or 30s in North America and in Britain, there would have been these touring vaudeville performances in a theater, and it would have been a variety show, right? Like, you would have gone and seen dancing girls and comedians and musicians of, you know, small trios or big bands or whatever, and they would do little dramatic sections, and all they're really doing is taking these performances and putting them on film. And they didn't bother with an audience. So we're watching this with no laugh track and no applause track, like no live audience. So it's almost spooky, like you're watching it in a quiet environment. So they finish their performance and they just take a bow and they go on to the next segment. So that was a little unnerving watching this. There's a running joke throughout where there's a man who's like an inventor, and he's figured out a way to watch this show from his house on TV, right? Like, he's trying to set up a crude television, and he sends, you know, every segment they come back to him, he's injuring himself and cutting his hand and bumping his forehead, and he can't get this thing to work. And that was like a running gag. So this would have been pretty funny stuff, I think, back in the day. The people watching this would have been the same people that would have gone to the vaudeville in the theater, and they probably would have enjoyed this. I don't think we quite got the same level of enjoyment from it.
Well, it's interesting because, like you say, the people who would have gone to see this would have been the same kind of people that went to see vaudeville. So the theaters would have been pretty packed, and people would have been laughing.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't have had an audience reaction track because they would have had an audience. And when they made this, they could never have predicted home videos. So yeah, here we are sitting at home watching this, but this isn't how it was meant to be seen.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of interesting that, you know, that we're able to watch this just as a historical...
Yeah.
You know, it's a historical oddity. I mean, there's some problematic scenes in it as well. Like, there's a couple of scenes. I think there's three or four blackface skits in this. And, you know, I knew what blackface was, and I'd seen a couple things, like, in old Disney cartoons and stuff like that. But I've never actually seen a blackface skit. And I'm, you know, one of the first one that comes up in the film is these three dudes in blackface, and they're tap dancing. And I'm like, what am I watching? Like, what is this, right? And... that's all it is just three people tap dancing, but they just are in blackface. And, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's odd. And I guess that was what entertainment was in the day, you know?
Well, yeah. And we know today we realize that blackface is, you know, culturally very inappropriate and offensive. Mm-hmm. But again, back then it would have been fairly common and fairly popular and funny. They do Dance Around in Your Bones, the song. They did the skit where they're in skeleton costumes.
Okay, yeah.
Later on in the film.
I might have been sleeping by that point.
Yeah, and so they did what was a popular song at the time. And
okay.
They come out in, like, black coveralls with the white ectoskeletons drawn on them. And they're dancing, and, like, it's kind of a comical piece. Like, almost like a Halloween theme sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like, you and I were watching this, at, you know, and thinking... wow, this is really hard to watch. Like, it's really boring, for one. We don't really like the music. And parts of this are offensive. But it's still...
it's a historical oddity.
It's an important piece to watch.
See, one of the things with this that I find frustrating with film, and I'm not schooled on this, you know, I'm not completely up on my social, politically correct things and stuff, but one film that I go back to when I think of something like this, like, I think these films are important to watch with the understanding of their historical significance, and we look at them today and understand that they're not appropriate, but it is a look at a moment in history. And one of the films that I really enjoy watching that, you know, it frustrates me that they have it this way is Fantasia, right? The Disney film Fantasia. And one of the skits, which I'm actually probably going to talk about Fantasia again later on when you bring up another topic. But one of the skits in Fantasia is the guys in that are half horse. What are they, centaurs? And they've got the little angels that kind of fly around and whatnot. And if you watch Fantasia, and I have it on Blu-ray, there's one quick cut. It's not very long that they cut to, and the quality of it is very grainy and very poor. And what's happened is they've actually zoomed in on the negative to get rid of one of these angels that's an inappropriate representation of a blackface character.
Oh, okay.
Right? So,
in the modern remastering of the DVD, they've done this.
Yes, yeah. They have. It's actually been, it's been quite a while. Like, in most of the home video releases that they've had, they've done this. But knowing that that's there and seeing the poor quality of just that section, like, something is lost. And... you know, I understand why they take it out, but it's like, do we just shut the door on this and ignore this kind of thing, you know? I don't know. It was really unnerving watching it for the first time, because I'm like, man, I have never seen anything like this in my life, and it's bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't enjoy watching it, but with the Fantasia, there's something that's missing from that film that was originally created that I don't know if we can ever get again.
You'd rather watch the original cut, the unedited version, the director's cut, right?
Because, like, it's only one shot. Yeah. Like, it's like a 3-second shot where this thing was edited out. It's not like this thing is everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, so, but in this, again, like, I'm not going to want to watch this. I don't think I'll ever watch this movie again, right? I've seen it. I appreciate it for it's what they tried to do. It's called historical significance, but I mean, would I have wanted to watch this without the blackface segments? Well, no, because it's a part of what the film was, and it's a part of understanding what happened at that time.
Now, how does this all relate to Hitchcock, right? So Hitchcock, his main contribution to this was he produced the comic segments about the man who was trying to tune the television set to watch the show, and his picture kept failing. You know, he was always tinkering with his technology, his TV. He also produced, it's a minute and 45, it's not even 2 minutes long. It's the skit where there's a couple that are having an affair. She's cheating on her husband. They're sitting on a couch in an apartment, and they're getting cuddly, and they're talking about, imagine this. It's a love triangle, you know. Hitchcock loves his triangles, right?
Yes.
We've talked about that in so many of his other films. But so this couple is on the couch, and the man sneaks in, who you'd imagine is the woman's husband, mm-hmm. catches the wife with this other man, pulls out a revolver and shoots them dead like a minute into the skit. And again, it's a Hitchcock, so you don't see like the violence. It's done off camera and stuff. But and then the joke is, I'm in the wrong flat.
Yeah, you like, but I'm in the wrong flat. So he's just killed the wrong people, right? I
killed the wrong couple. Like what do I do now, Charlie? You know, like,
and then that's the end of the skit.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. And that's classic. Like, it's a brilliant, like, you can tell that's a Hitchcock piece right there. Mm-hmm. It's done very properly and very, you know, very high society style and everything. But that was, you know, and that joke lives on in modern sort of, you know, party jokes or stories that people joke about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Killing their partner to run away with their affair or the love interest, and then, wrong house or whatever. But I think Hitchcock wasn't too concerned. In the Hitchcock-Truffaut book, when Truffaut asks him, and he says, in 1930 you were asked to direct some sequences for the British musical comedy Elstree Calling, and all Hitchcock says, that's of no interest whatever. Like, he has no concern about this. He mm-hmm. doesn't put any weight in this.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a one-off for him, and he doesn't really want to talk about it.
He got his 50 bucks and moved on.
Yeah, and when you, on our Facebook page, which I know everybody follows religiously, we posted the poster.
Mm-hmm.
And in the poster, you know, it's a wonderful comedy review, like all these different people that are involved, and all the names. And it's one of those films that you would have gone just because of the famous actor that was included, and that was how they promoted it, with the variety of famous names and musicians that were featured.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a variety show. It's kind of like the modern, you know, the more modern stuff, like the Carol Burnett Variety Hour or the Wayne and Schuster stuff that would have been on TV
mm-hmm.
in the last 10 or 20 years in Canada. It's a antiquated concept, though. Like, we don't really... It's kind of like the Tonight Show on NBC, mm-hmm. almost, where they have a comedian come on, but and then they'll do a musical piece, or the late-night talk show format. But it is a very distant concept that... They promoted it as the big singing and dancing Cine Radio Review, a constellation of stars of stage, screen, and broadcast fame. And they list all the different names. That was how they were promoting it.
Well, tell the listeners as well what they were planning on doing with other countries.
Oh, yeah. And there was a concept where they were going to take the same format, like all the segments, but replace the hosting MC
mm-hmm.
with a foreign language host in the different countries, so they could promote it and sell it in different regions of the world. I don't think they ever did that.
No, they didn't. That was the intention, but they never did that. And that makes me think of Fantasia as well, because when Fantasia came out, the original intention of Fantasia is that it would travel the country, and they would keep cycling through different skits. Like, they would keep it fresh by putting new segments of songs in. You've seen Fantasia, right?
Yeah.
So they would remove one and put in another one or whatnot. And so when Fantasia 2000 came out, they did that where they kept the magician, the one with Mickey Mouse,
the Conjurer.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice. They kept that one in the 2000 version, but the rest all changed. So that was the intention behind that.
And the MC of Elstree Calling, too, is one of the books that we source our material from for the show referred to this as a crude farce, mm-hmm. this whole movie. And the MC is doing some very kind of racy, sexist comments about the dancing girls and having their home addresses and all these things that really speak to the era that would not necessarily be considered appropriate today.
Mm-hmm. So I'll read a little bit on the movie here. The first section I'm going to read here, I'm just going to read the one paragraph. So Alfred Hitchcock, The Complete Films by Paul Duncan, only has one paragraph on this film. So I'm just going to read that paragraph. The coming of sound meant that traditional variety hall acts like singers and comedians could now perform on the silver screen. Several successful films of musical and comedy revues had been made in America, and British International Pictures wanted to emulate their success in the UK. The result was Elstree Calling from 1930. Britain's first musical, cobbled together by various different producers and directors. Hitch contributed the framing device of a family trying to watch the show on their television set, a short parody of Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, and a sketch called Thriller. Apparently, Hitch did not spend more than 7 hours on the set.
Wow.
So.
And it shows.
And it shows. Even in the Art of Alfred Hitchcock, 50 Years of His Motion Pictures by Donald Spado, there's only about a paragraph on that. But I'll also read some of the notes that I've got. Again, these notes here are from Wikipedia and from the Hitchcock Zone. So the film is referred to as a Cine Radio Review, and in its original publicity, that's how they referred to it. It's a lavish musical film review and is Britain's answer to the Hollywood reviews, which had been produced by major studios in the United States, such as Paramount on Parade, also for 1930, and the Hollywood Review of 1929. The review has a slim storyline about it being a television broadcast. The film consists of 19 comedy and music vignettes linked by running jokes of an aspiring Shakespeare actor and technical problems with a viewer's TV set. Hitchcock's contribution was the comic linking segments about a man trying to tune in the review on his television set, but always failing to get the picture for long because of his needless tinkering. And in the UK, John Logie Baird's work in mechanical television in the 1920s made television a topical subject at the time. Imitating the lavish use of Technicolor by Hollywood studios at the time, two sequences in the film were artificially colored by the Pathacolor process, which used stencils to tint selected areas of the black and white prints. Now, so Pathacolor, later renamed Pathachrome, was an early mechanical stencil-based film tinting process for movies developed by Segundo de Comon for Pathé in the early 20th century. One of the last feature films to use the process was Elstree Calling. The Pathacolor stencil process should not be confused with the later Pathacolor, which is one word, and then Pathacolor, which is two words, and Color by Pathé, trade names seen in screen credits and advertising materials. Like Metricolor, Warner Color, and Color by Deluxe, these were simply rebrandings for advertising purposes of the use of Eastman Kodak's Eastman Color negative film for the original photography. The stencil process was not a color photography process and did not use color film. Like computer-based film colorization processes, it was a way of arbitrarily adding selected colors to films originally photographed and printed in black and white. Each frame of an extra print of the black and white film to be colored was rear projected onto a sheet of frosted glass, as in rotoscoping. An operator used a blunt stylus to trace the outlines of areas of the projected image that were to be tinted in one particular color. The stylus was connected to a reducing pantograph that caused a sharp blade to cut corresponding outlines through the actual film frame, creating a stencil for that color in the frame. This had to be done for each individual frame, and as many different stencil films had to be made as there were different colors to be added. Each of the final projection prints was matched up with one of the stencil films and run through a machine that applied the corresponding dye through the stencil. This operation was repeated using each of the different stencils and dyes in turn. Now, according to contemporary newspaper reports, British International Pictures planned to release alternative versions of Elstree Calling in 9 foreign languages, and each version would replace the linking footage of Tommy Handley with a famous actor from that country, and some of the segments would be replaced with local acts and performers. And so there was 4 directors for this film. Alfred Hitchcock did some of it, but the other directors were André Charlot, Jack Hulbert, and Paul Murray. And that's all the information that we have on Elm Street Calling.
I don't want to be totally negative. I think it's worth people watching this if they're interested. And it's segments. Like, you'd watch half an hour of it, come back, watch the rest later.
Right. You're not going to lose any plot.
Yeah, and it's a historical piece. It's worth watching. You might actually find... I found parts of it funny.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the Shakespearean actor's part, that I found that amusing.
Yeah.
I enjoyed his bits.
And he was the blackmailer in Blackmail.
Okay.
So we saw him in Blackmail once before.
And talking about slapstick, there's this scene where, I forget the context, but the two men are literally just standing there slapping each other back and yes. forth, back and forth, you know, in the face. But I don't want to scare people away. I think it's worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
If it's all over the internet, like there's copies available online.
It's on DVD. You can buy it on DVD.
Yeah, have a look at it. I think it's, you know, it's worth watching.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a rating out of 5?
One slap in the face.
Yeah. Actually, I was feeling generous, and I awarded this 2 out of 5 really big tuxedos. Like, really big. So...
I give it a 1 because, like, it's, again, yeah, it's not bad, but it's like, why am I watching this? You know, like, this is not the kind of entertainment that I watch. So to sit down for 80 minutes and watch this is just, it's painful for me,
mm-hmm.
you know. But like I said, I really enjoyed the big guy with the drums and when he came back to do the, I can't remember which was first, but when he came back to do the other one, whether it was the xylophone or the drums, like, he's pretty talented. It was pretty cool to watch. And,
yeah.
You know, so yeah, definitely check it out. It doesn't hurt to check it out.
So, as we like to say, how can folks follow us on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me on Trek FM with new episodes of The Edge, which is our Star Trek Discovery podcast. You can find me on Trek FM as well, doing Warp 5, which is our Star Trek Enterprise podcast. And I think that's about it going on right now.
Use as much as I can my Instagram as the Tom Caldwell. I know there's so many imposters out there.
It should be the real Tom. You should change it to the real Tom Caldwell.
of course, we have a pretty good community on Facebook,
mm-hmm.
following our little podcast, and on Twitter. And I know Chris Haig is very busy with his North by Nerd West, his mm-hmm. podcast. And we always enjoy having conversations with him. Mm-hmm. We'll get back shortly, as soon as we can, to try and have the three of us on each show. And we're going to mix it up and pair off into different pairs for coming up episodes. And we really appreciate everybody listening and following the show and promoting it. And hope they can keep in touch.
Yeah, and Chris is available on Twitter at @hire_boy. And as always, we're a part of the Fandom Podcast Network at FanPod Network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @GoodEveningPod. And don't forget to check out our good friends, Annie and Catherine, who host Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they're going through all the episodes of that show. And I've been following along as well. And they're not doing it in chronological order. They are jumping around all over the 7 seasons. But it's a lot of fun, and I'm really enjoying watching it for my first time going through it. So with their podcast and ours, you get a near comprehensive look at the Grandmaster Hitchcock.
For sure.
Well, I guess that's all we've got for us tonight. So stay tuned next week. We're going to be covering, not next week, but the next episode we'll be doing Juno and the Paycock. And if you can find a copy with subtitles, that'll probably help you out.
Get the subtitles.
The version that we have did not. But until then, the only thing we have left to say is good evening.
Good evening.